Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Nigeria seems to be on the verge of a civil war. The instigator of the escalating sectarian conflict is a militant Islamic sect known as the Boko Haram. The Boko Haram seems bent on toppling the government and bringing Sharia law to Nigeria. The group is blamed for killing more than 300 people, more than half of them during attacks last month in the northern city of Kano. To get an insider's perspective, we'll talk with a foreign correspondent in Nigeria and two Nigerian journalists. Togo Ugunlese will be speaking to us from Lagos, Nigeria's largest city. Tolu writes a weekly column for a Nigerian newspaper, and he contributes articles to several British-based publications along with CNN's website. Omoyele Sowore is the founder of Sahara Reporters, an online community of international reporters and social advocates who write news reports and commentaries from an African perspective. And Monica Mark is the Guardian newspaper's Nigeria stringer and a contributor to Time magazine. She's been focusing on sectarian violence in the country and recently interviewed a member of the Boko Haram sect. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a bit of a time delay, so we'll work with that. I think that Monica and Tolu are in Lagos, and Omoyele is in New York. So religion seems to be the underlying cause of the conflict in this country, where by and large Muslims live in the north and Christians live in the south. Or maybe it's the socioeconomic divide. Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer and supplies a significant percentage of the oil used in the United States. But the oil wells and most of the nation's wealth are in the south. Sowore, would you briefly outline some of the underlying reasons for the growth of the Boko Haram?
Basically, I'm of the school of thought that Boko Haram and many other militant groups in Nigeria have come to exist due to socio-political problems and economic problems in the country, particularly the massive mismanagement of Nigeria's wealth in the last 50 years, which has created a lot of dislocations and left a huge amount of young people unemployed and unable to fend for themselves. The reason why I make this very clear in my thoughts is to just let people understand, people who don't know Nigeria, that it is not only in the north that you have militant groups. We just finished dealing with the militant groups from the Niger Delta region. If you go to the southeastern part of Nigeria, there are militant groups who engage strictly in kidnapping. Different parts of Nigeria, there are a bunch of criminal groups engaged also in armed robbery and all kinds of means of making money or trying to take back some part of the Nigerian wealth that has been looted over the years. Of course, most of these militant groups have motivation. They have, ideological and religious basis for whatever they are doing, and it happens that Boko Haram had its own religious roots in the Salafist movement, especially since 2009, after their leader, Muhammad Yusuf, was killed extrajudicially by the Nigerian police. But don't forget that they have been in existence since 2001 and have just organized and helped themselves with jobs, with marriage, and those are the things that government had failed to provide for them. It was after the killing of the leader in 2009, in July, that the group became really very violent and has since fought and killed and destroyed. As of today, they've killed almost 800 people in various attacks across across the northern parts of Nigeria.
Tolo, from your perspective, do you agree on, and what do you think has caused the rise of militant Islam?
Oh, yes. Definitely. I think that one thing at the bottom of this, we must all acknowledge that it's a complicated situation. So it's not one single factor. It's more likely to be a combination of factors, you know, that's responsible for chaos and the violence. So of course, there's militant Islam, which you can link, of course, to, you know, Al Qaeda influences, globalization. I mean, this rise in militant Islam is happening in many parts of the world. You know, I mean, with simple 9/11, we've seen, you know, what happened with Afghanistan and Pakistan and all of that. You know, but at the same time, we must also focus on the local, you know, peculiarly Nigerian issues of massive government failure, so that there is a huge pool of young Nigerians who, you know, to put it bluntly, do not have or see a future for themselves. Now, this pool of young people is a willing army in the hands of anybody who can, you know, instigate them to violence. You know, they don't need any, you know, they don't need any logical arguments to push them. These people are disenchanted with the system and with the society. So it's important to understand that, you know, that we have, you know, a high youth unemployment rate, for example. So there's a waiting willing army of young people. So but at the same time, I think at this point I should talk about, I mean, we know, yeah, the Max Weber definition, the classic definition of a state as having a legitimate monopoly, yeah, on violence.
Okay.
Now, in Nigeria's case, that theory does not hold. That the state no longer has that monopoly. It has, the state has abdicated that monopoly on violence.
Right.
I could say tens of armed groups, which is what, as Mr. Shuren said, it's not just in the north.
Okay. And so I'll move on to Monica and get her engaged in this conversation also.
Yeah.
Before we get into the government's response, some observers are pushing for international intervention, and others say that that would do more harm than good, and believe that, you know, like Tolo's saying, government corruption is a big culprit. Monica, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is in Britain this week, and there were some comments about Prime Minister Cameron pledging cooperation in the fight against terrorism. What's your view on the possibility of outside intervention and whether that would be a good thing?
I think, like, the same as in all cases where you're considering international intervention within the borders of a sovereign country, it requires a serious understanding of, you know, the cultural situation you're operating in. And it's hard for many Nigerians to fully understand the situation, alone someone coming outside of Nigeria to intervene. There are ways that foreign international community can help with, you know, they can sort of, there's definitely logistical help, you know, Nigeria to do with that. But I think there's been a tendency for the international community to see, you know, as soon as you mentioned the Islamist group, to sort of think of Al-Qaeda and so on. But I think we need to be very careful, because essentially this is a situation that's defined by its local ambitions, the local political context. And there's a need to tread very carefully when you're bringing in people,
right,
from outside. So to deal with this very local problem.
Right. So you mentioned Al-Qaeda, and there seems to be some tenuous links. And I guess people's understanding of militant Islam. Sometimes people think of the Taliban. Are there similarities between the Boko Haram and the Taliban, and how are they similar and different, Monica?
Well, the interview that I did, the spokesperson that I for Boko Haram, who uses the name Abu Bakr, was quite clear that they see Al-Qaeda as their spiritual brothers. He claimed that they have met with senior leaders of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, but I think that's something that needs to be treated very, very carefully. Whether they have, I would be dubious whether they have firm links with Al-Qaeda, but I think it's become pretty clear, even with the death of Osama, that isn't going to stop. The movement has gone way beyond just one man, one country. I think these groups, many groups like Boko Haram, may draw inspiration from these groups, but I don't know whether they, as everyone has mentioned previously, it is really quite a local. They use a fanatical ideology, but they're still operating very much in a local. Even in Nigeria, they're only in the north of Nigeria at the moment. So I think we sort of have to very carefully these any allegations that. Right. There's a serious link between all these groups.
Shamora, how has the Boko Haram affected the lives of normal Nigerians?
It is not different from the way the lives are affected by the way the Nigerian state has been run down. The truth is that the region of Nigeria is plagued by one, armed conflict or the other. To the extent that the Nigerian army is bogged down within Nigeria right now, helping either to fight crime or to fight Boko Haram or to fight the Niger Delta insurgency that seems to be coming back, or to help fight inter-ethnic wars that are happening, because Nigeria is being mismanaged to the point that it has broken down. Security has broken down. Most of what we're talking about today are simple law enforcement issues. Monica is probably in Lagos, and she must have heard about what they call the local area boys and motor garage touts 4 or 3 days ago engaged in a free-for-all fight in the downtown area of Lagos, burning down properties and killing about 4 people. There are a lot of gangs around, and most of them, by the way, are linked with politicians. As a matter of fact, the Niger Delta insurgency started with politicians arming local thugs with AK-47s in the year 2003. By the time they were done with them, the guys turned to militancy. There's also been a direct link between Boko Haram and local politicians, using them to fight their opponents in elections or rig or manipulate results of election. So all of these have political connections and nexus and connotation as well, that every major crime you see in Nigeria, every major militancy you see in Nigeria has some kind of political connection. There's always the big man who is also involved in corruption, funding or directly using this as a means of political control. So that part is also there, and that is why it is very important to let people know that this whole notion that Al-Qaeda is in Nigeria is very tenuous. But I think it sells newspapers in the West to say, well, Al-Qaeda has moved to Nigeria. This a lot of these issues are still localized issues. It's just that the Nigerian government has failed in its duties, both in providing infrastructure for the people, security, food, employment, medicine. That is what has destroyed the Nigerian society to the point that everybody has tried to carve out their own little fiefdom, and they are competing most of the time for turf.
Right.
These gangs and criminal groups.
Tell us, Omoyele, tell us about Sahara reporters and the citizen journalists who provide reports from inside Nigeria, how they operate and how dangerous it is for them to get at the underlying reasons for some of these problems.
Well, our reporting style is different from the mainstream way of reporting news. What we do is that we're using social networks, social media, we're using mobile platforms to report news. And what basically we do is have citizen reporters who are not identified by anybody, and it could be anybody, by the way, report directly things that they see to us, either by text messages, photos, and videos. And when we get them, we process them here in New York and verify and publish. So it makes it possible for us to get direct information, makes it possible for us to get accurate information, and most importantly, to provide evidence and evidence-backed reporting to the world. And we've done this even as of today. We were the first to report about the Boko Haram attacks, both in Kano and Minna in Niger State. So, like in every situation, it is dangerous for anybody to use their phone cameras in front of Boko Haram gunmen, but we've been getting by pretty well with that style of reporting. And in places where it's absolutely difficult for even the mainstream media, even Western journalists to report,
right,
we've been able to break the barriers of reporting.
Right, Monica, and let's move to Monica, and please talk about your experience in covering the Boko Haram. Generally, how do journalists even make contact with this secretive sect? And you managed to talk with a spokesperson from Boko Haram recently. How did you manage to get the interview, and how was it a dangerous move?
I managed through a local intermediary. I mean, like all groups, Boko Haram operate underground, so that's one of the difficulties as a foreign correspondent, where you need to trust the source is making contact with a faceless group. I'm saying they're faceless, but they are obviously, they're known to people within their communities. So as a foreign correspondent, we've been trained to cut out the middleman and to go direct to the source. Most of the time, you can't do that with Boko Haram. That creates some problems because it means you're relying on an intermediary, and they may or they may not necessarily have the same, or they may have an agenda. They may be very close to the source. They might not necessarily have the same standards of objectivity and there are problems, and I think this is not just in Nigeria, but having worked in other countries in Africa where often you just have to, it takes a whole team to bring a news story.
Right.
There's the worry that you're endangering other people apart from yourself. And of course, local translators, fixers, bringers tend to come under far more pressure from the government. And that affects their ability to work and the work that they can produce. So it's tough. That's one way of approaching Boko Haram through intermediaries. The other thing that's very difficult, and a colleague, Tony will also know, was killed last month when it's particularly difficult for photographers and video journalists who actually have to be at the scene, because at the end of the day, even though we have social media, somebody has to go to the scene to report it. And that's when it becomes, it's a stressful situation. Each time you're putting yourself in danger, you have to really believe that what you're going to produce is worth the risk that you're taking.
Wow.
And it's not just Boko Haram. It's also the police in Nigeria are not exactly, they can also endanger you. So
right.
It's hard work.
Because several journalists have been killed in the past year. And Tolu, what's your experience like trying to cover this? Have you has your life been in danger? And some of the colleagues that you know.
Well, I have not been involved in any direct reporting of the situation. I live in Lagos, which until now at the moment is sort of still removed from the main theater of violence, which is mostly in states in the north, Abuja, the capital, and north of Abuja. So I don't have any direct experience. But I also know that a TV journalist was killed last month while covering one of the bomb attacks. I know that journalists have been targeted by Boko Haram. But I note also that this is also part of a wider move by the sect to intimidate, you know, all anybody that is the term an opponent. So it's not only journalists, you know, local politicians, even moderate Muslims. You know, so this is not about them just targeting people who are non-Muslims. But, you know, in fact, I think that many of the high-profile targets have been, you know, Muslims who do not exactly share their beliefs. And which also leads to the suspicion that there is more than one faction, and that, you know, there are a number of factions of the sect, you know, who do not exactly agree on the best way, on the amount of violence to deploy or the targets to select.
Okay.
So that's my point of view.
All right. I'd like to ask each of you what you see in the future of Nigeria. But before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles and photos and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. Now, there's an AP story out this morning that says the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria said his nation is offering support for the West African country's fight against a radical Islamist sect, but has ruled out sending troops into the region, even though it's vital to American oil supplies. Do you perceive that if things get worse, there may be some sort of outside intervention or help in Nigeria?
It's a really delicate situation, and I'm not sure even within the country people have grasped really exactly the best way to deal with the situation. So I'm a bit dubious about an intervention in this case, military intervention. And I think has also been mentioned, this is as much an economic problem as a political problem as a security. So even if you deal with the situation in a military way, you're still going to have the issues that have come together to create groups like Boko Haram and, you know, vigilante groups in the Niger Delta now. So I don't think that even if a military, outside military intervention might be one way to deal with it, it requires numerous ways of dealing with the problem, and certainly this is not going to stop it, just
right,
having foreign troops stationed in Nigeria.
Right. And Shomori, President Goodluck Jonathan has significantly increased the amount of money spent on security. Do you think the government's capable of controlling this problem?
If you ask the average Nigerian, they're not going to be very optimistic about pouring money into. Nigeria has a massive corruption problem. Putting money into it, I don't think. There's a breakdown of trust between the average citizen and the government, and there's not much space to it.
Right. Shomori, what's your view on this?
The joke about, pouring money is what happened last week, I think about a week and a half ago in Kaduna, where an anti-bomb unit police officer approached a bomb with his bare hands and just wearing T-shirts. And he was blown up it was blown into pieces right by a bomb, an IED, right in front of a crowd of about 2,000 people watching. And this is a country that spends $7 billion on security alone and couldn't even buy anti-bomb suits to protect officers who are detonating, who are defusing bombs. So all of that security budget you see and money, they all go into corruption. They have them buy Porsche cars and, you know, buy mansions abroad and airplanes. And it's all nonsense.
Is there corruption in the media as well?
In the media, you should ask Tolu about it.
Tolu, what do you think about the corruption in the media?
Well, yes. One mistake I think Nigerians often make, you know, and it's a mistake I make a lot of time also, is to speak of corruption as though, you know, it was limited to the public sector, to the government. But actually, you know, it cuts across the entire society. private sector corruption, you know, may actually be worse than what we find in the public sector. And of course, the media is not left out, so that there's a culture of journalists collecting tips. Because they are, well, I mean, this is not a justification, but because they are not often well paid, you know, they are some of the least paid, you know, workers in society. I heard a governor, a state governor, say last December that 80% of the news we hear in Nigeria is paid for.
I'm sorry, you said 80% of the news is...
No, he's a governor, you know, so I'm sure he's got a huge media budget and stuff. So the government alone is not alone in this. You know, a lot of the money that is stolen by government actually funneled into media houses to shape news and information and perception.
Well, the I think we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Shawori Omoyele, the founder of Sahara Reporters, columnist Tolu Ugunlese from Lagos, and Monica Marks of The Guardian. Now, I want to commend you, all three of you, for the bravery you exhibit in trying to, in reporting about this country and the underlying problems that are happening there. And I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
So Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Saravani Pera was our lead producer. And now stay tuned for Free Press Watch. And join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
Now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Lainey Mullen. Today's news comes from the International Press Institute, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and Reporters Without Borders. Anthony Shadid, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and correspondent for the New York Times, died of an apparent asthma attack in Syria last week. Shadid, who appeared in an episode of Global Journalist last year, was known for his courageous and insightful stories about the Middle East. He and photographer Tyler Hicks had crossed the Syrian border secretly to interview protesters, and while leaving the country on foot, Shadid collapsed. Hicks tried to resuscitate him and finally carried his body across the border to Turkey. Two other foreign journalists were killed by mortar shells in Homs, Syria, last week. That brings the total to 7 journalists killed in Syria since the start of the conflict. In Thailand, the editor of a news website, Prachatai, is facing possible 20-year sentence for not removing certain comments quickly enough from her website. The comments were said to have insulted the monarchy. The verdict will be decided on April 30th. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Lainey Mullen. See you next week.